Thank you, Sue. We will now move on to agenda paper 3. In this paper, we address a request about the consequential amendment that IFRS 9 made to paragraph 82A of IS 1. That consequential amendment requires an entity to present, separately in profit or loss, interest revenue calculated using the effective interest method. The submitter asked whether that new requirement affects the presentation of fair value gains or loss on particular derivative instruments. The submission, as well as the three views that the submitter identifies in practice, are reproduced in Appendix A. We want to draw your attention to the fact that the scope of the analysis presented in this paper is intentionally narrow and addresses only the consequential amendment that IFRS 9 made to paragraph 82A of IS 1. In contrast, this paper does not analyze or provide a staff view on any broader matter related to the presentation of over interest amounts in the statement of comprehensive income. The amendment that IFRS 9 made to paragraph 82A of IS 1 does not affect those matters. We also want to draw your attention to the fact that IFRS 9 is effective for annual periods beginning on or after January 1st, 2018, and therefore we think this matter is urgent in nature. As explained in paragraphs 12 to 20 of the paper, the effective interest method applies only to those financial instruments for which amortized cost is calculated. Amortized cost accounting, including interest revenue calculated using the effective interest method, and credit losses calculated using the expected credit loss impairment model, is applied only to financial assets measured at amortized cost and fair value through other comprehensive income. Consequently, we think the requirements set out in paragraph 82A of IS 1 to present separately interest revenue calculated using the effective interest method applies only to the financial assets in those two measurement categories. As explained in paragraph 21 to 23, we think our conclusion is consistent with the fact that this presentation requirement was discussed, exposed, and ultimately added to IS 1 by the phase of the IFRS 9 project that addressed amortized cost measurement and impairment methodology. We think our conclusion is also consistent with the board's views on the relevance and usefulness of the information provided by the effective interest method and amortized cost measurement. In other words, the requirements in paragraph 82A of IS 1 would result in relevant and useful information only about financial assets measured at amortized cost or at fair value through other comprehensive income. I would like to stop here and discuss question 1 shown on page 7 of the agenda paper and ask whether you agree with our analysis of the requirements in paragraph 82A of IS 1.
Thank you, Von Santen. Before I open it up for the committee members, I can't resist but just to add in my tuppence worth on a couple of points, but also I think it's important to re-emphasise what Von Santen's already said on a couple of aspects of the paper. So the first thing is, if you look at the submission that we receive and compare it with the question that we've asked, you can see that they are a little bit different. And the reason why we decided to do that, and we did talk to the submitter to let them know that that was what we were going to do and they were comfortable with us taking this approach, was because we were concerned, particularly given the timing of this discussion and the potential scope of the ramifications of us talking more generally about the presentation of amounts related to derivatives and other comprehensive the statement of profit or loss, that we may go beyond what the consequential amendment was that came with IFRS 9. So if I start, you know, writing a paper about can you have interest on derivatives, that's quite a broad question, and it's not one that was directly affected by IFRS 9, say, or the...
I'm sorry, but I do not hear your voice at all.
No. Somebody please get Bob to ring young Sue so he knows we can hear him. And also, please ask if he could mute, because I think he's listening to the meeting and now we're going to get feedback, so I apologise. So we didn't want to open up things beyond what the consequential amendment to IS1 had addressed, because they've got big implications for the market. On the one hand, on the face of it, that may look as though we'd actually broadened the question, because the question came in asking specifically about trading derivatives, and we're now addressing not just derivatives indirectly through this paper, but also non-derivatives. But that's because of the scope of the requirements in that IAS1 line, which we still thought was a more appropriate question to be answering at this point in time, given the timing of IFRS 9, so that's the context. What we've very carefully tried not to do in this paper, and what I think we should be careful not to do as a committee, is to go broader than the question of this particular line item. So the whole paper is set up to discuss what is required to be in this particular line item that's referenced in IAS1. Whether or not people then want to present other items that they might label interest, what other items they might have as line items within what they may calculate as net interest margin, is, for my, as far as I'm concerned, beyond the scope of this discussion. So I would like to try, and I will police it if I need to, try and keep the discussion to what exactly is IAS 182A talking about in that particular line item that's described in that paragraph. We're trying to reduce the knock-on effects. So with that very long introduction, now you know the rules. Who's brave enough to go first? Reinhardt? Twitching.
I'm not brave or foolish, but I'll try to play by the rules. So I guess when I looked at the agenda paper and the draft tentative agenda decision, it struck me that although, as you mentioned, Sue and then Song, the question that the submitter raised was a very narrow scope question, and we tried to broaden it to be helpful to address what we think the amendments to IS1 paragraph 82 mean. Having said that, from a personal perspective, I would not come to the same conclusion as the staff with respect to the presentation in of what can be presented as interest revenue calculated using the effective interest method under paragraph 82A of IS1. And what I mean by that is I certainly agree with respect to derivatives that are in a non-hedging relationship that presenting an interest component in that line item would not make sense for a number of reasons, quite simply, one being that for those instruments, they're recognized on a fair value basis through P&L. And there, I think, arguably, based on some of the wording in IFRS 9, is not an interest component. It's really interest accruals on a notional amount. And I think some of the discussion in IFRS 9 would support that. And so I don't see any basis for, given these words in paragraph 82, to split for those types of instruments. Having said that, where you have a non-derivative financial instrument, let's say, as example, could have met the SPPI criterion or is in a held to collect and sell type business model, but you choose to recognize it fair value through P&L, I don't agree that you would be precluded from showing and the interest component in IS in paragraph 82A, because you can compute the interest on that using the effective interest method. And what I look at is 82A says interest revenue calculated using the effective interest method. And so although the amortized cost method requires the use of the effective interest method, I'm not sure that necessarily the reverse holds true, at least in my mind. And so I think for example, non-derivative instruments where you can compute interest using the effective interest method, and you've chosen to show those at fair value to the P&L, because to avoid some of the hedge accounting implications, and you're doing effectively economic hedging, if you will, recognizing that on a fair value basis in the P&L, I think personally you could split that interest revenue out and include it in that line item. So as I say, although I agree with the analysis insofar as it pertains to derivatives in a non-hedging relationship, I would have personally kept it at that because I personally don't agree with the broadening as to what the implications are for other types of instruments, including non-derivatives, financial instruments at fair value through P&L. Okay.
Thank you. Others? John?
I mean, I agree with the staff analysis. I think IFRS 9, the effective interest method, is an integral part of the amortized cost measurement, and IFRS 9 has determined what assets are subject to amortized cost measurement and what assets are subject to fair value measurement. So to me, in making a consequential amendment to IAS 1, paragraph 82, and talking about revenue under the effective interest method, it seems to me the intention was pretty clear to pick up revenue on amortized cost or items for which amortized cost is calculated in accordance with IFRS 9, so I would agree with the staff. I also agree there's nothing that prevents someone from adding other amounts in the income statement calculated in accordance with other methods, but I don't think they're part of the effective interest method under IFRS 9, so I would agree with the staff analysis and conclusion.
Okay, thanks, John. Bob?
I don't disagree with the result of the staff's analysis, and that may have been the board's intent, and probably the disaggregation in the income statement of having a line solely for interest on those instruments that are at amortized cost is probably useful information. Where I struggle a little bit with the staff's analysis, and I can see it being read in two ways. When I look to the definition of effective interest method, one way of reading it is as the staff has, but it says that the method is used in the calculation of amortized cost, and it's the method used in allocation and recognition of interest revenue or interest expense. And so I think another reading is it serves two purposes. One is in the calculation of amortized cost. The other purpose is when you have an instrument with an interest component, it is used in the allocation of what is the interest in that instrument. And so I think about a convertible bond. Now under IFRS 9, that will not meet SPPI. I have to do fair value through P&L on that, but I definitely have an interest component in there. How do I recognize that interest component? I always think of that as that's the interest method. So I'm struggling with where the staff says that the effective interest method is only allowed when you have amortized cost.
And you think that even though IFRS 9 would prohibit you from applying that approach to measurement on the convertible bond because we prohibit bifurcation on financial assets?
That's where I was going, yes.
Bruce.
Okay. Thanks. I actually agreed with where the staff got to. I mean, when I read it, I kind of felt that ATA was quite clear in terms of how I get there. The only comment I had was similar to yours, that my concern was the question became a lot more around starting to creep into what are the items that can go in there. So I think providing we caveated it strongly enough that we don't start including that discussion, I'd be comfortable with where we got to.
Thank you. Tony?
Yeah, I agree with where the staff's got to for pretty much the same reasons as John described. I think the only question that I had is that it seemed to say that the effective interest model applies only to financial instruments that are subsequently measured at amortized cost, and I wondered about derivatives that are in effective hedging relationships and whether we ought to be clear that if it is in an effective hedging relationship then it would adjust the
And I think that's fine because hedge accounting is sort of an overlay, to use my very simplistic terminology, but yeah. Yes. And I think that's why the submission said trading derivatives, to try and distinguish it, but maybe in the draft agenda decision we haven't brought that out as clearly as we might. Michael?
Yes, I agree with the staff analysis as regards derivatives, that it's clearly not part of what was intended by 82A of IS1, and different in nature, people want to present that and it should be presented differently. To your point about broadening the question, which I agree with, I just wonder if it is something that could be noted for either presentation project or macro hedging, that there probably are some interesting questions to be dealt with.
Yes, and I think that if you looked at the primary financial statements papers that we discussed at the board this month, we were being very specific and tiptoeing around this whole area. Andrew, I think you're next.
Thank you. I agree with the staff analysis in the paper, and like others, I would take the distinction back to the measurement attribute that IFRS 9 requires and link it to that. And so if IFRS 9 says fair value, then I wouldn't view that as being something that you would put in here because you're measuring it differently. Like Tony, though, I would be minded to look at derivatives that are designated in an effective hedging relationship and do things in rather the same way as we do at the moment. The only other thing that occurred to me was that one question that that's left a little bit open at the moment, and maybe it's intentional, is that we talk about interest revenue, and it seemed to me that there might be a question in some constituents' mind of, if we've got that, then what's interest revenue and what's finance income? And what's the difference between the two? And the only quick way that I could think of that you might then bring out the distinction is just to link it back to the definition of revenue and say, if for you interest is revenue, that's your line, and if it's not, it's not. But that's a subsidiary part. In the main, I agree with what the staff have got.
Okay, thank you. Young Sue, can you hear us yet? Okay, no, we can't hear you.
Sorry.
We can't hear you.
Sorry.
No, Young Sue, we can't hear you.
So I think maybe you're on mute.
Yes. I tried it out again. Now you can hear me. So many trouble. I missed a lot of discussions, so I do not know what the other people said. But what I'm trying to say is two things. First one, I agree with the staff analysis. Very logical and understandable. But still, I have one question. And, you know, I just like to extend the scope of the agenda decision a little bit. You know, I think that, you know, many fair value P&L items may contain interest component. So my question is whether this agenda decision prohibits companies from reporting interest components of the fair value P&L items separately from the other revenue or not.
Yes, and I...
That is the question I have.
Yeah. And what I said in the tee-up, which you missed, unfortunately, apologies, was that we were trying to just focus in the agenda decision on what is required to be included in this particular line item. It wouldn't, for your fact pattern, prevent somebody from having a separate interest line item, which might include the sort of interest components on items that are measured at fair value through profit or loss, but it would be a separate line item. So, and maybe in the agenda decision, if we publish it, we'd need to make it a little bit more clear that we're not sort of touching on that, and that it's very much about this, what the particular requirement is for this line item mentioned in IAS 1. Bertrand.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bertrand?
I agree with the staff conclusion, and just to echo what Tony and Andrew said, I would probably emphasize a bit more the fact that hedging instruments are excluded from this, maybe not just reflecting what was entailed in the submission, but maybe in our own conclusion in the tentative agenda
okay.
decision.
I think it's a good suggestion. Jim?
I agree with the staff analysis, and I also agree with broadening the approach to other than the derivatives, since I think it's very important to send out a message that the 9 is different from the traditional categories, usually for Bob mentioned the convertible bonds or the more complex financial instruments. They are components of interest, but other components too. I think that's why you guys designed the SBPI test. With the test, we should simplify the measurement and the reporting to the fair value through P&L. That's it. If we gave them other ways to report the tiny or the kind of a proportion of interest-bearing instrument within the complexity of the whole instrument, that will give us all the way back to the traditional ways of understanding the financial reporting. I think we should use the word only to and give the concept out. So in my understanding, we don't even need to have the consequently paragraph on the agenda decision, even though Sue explained why you put this consequently paragraph to avoid further broadening the only two's limitation. But I think shouldn't that be the purpose, to simplify and just to have these kind of complex financial instruments reported on the single through P&L line. That's it. So I think we should stay on the original way of issuing IFRS 9, the A better simplified version. But at the same time, we know we're going to eliminate some of the detailed components of interest-bearing way of getting revenue through P&L. That's it.
Bob.
Let me come back and ask the staff to answer the question you asked me. Is it the staff's intent that the effective interest method is prohibited for an instrument that is not at amortized cost, or a method that is exactly like, but we'll call it a different term than effective interest method for an instrument that's not at amortized cost?
Let me answer your question sort of in two parts. The staff paper, as I understand it, which I happen to agree with what it's worth, would say that this particular line item could only be populated with amounts where the effective interest method had been applied to items actually measured at amortized cost and fair value through OCI, subject to the hedge accounting comments. If people thought that it was appropriate to calculate an EIM type amount on a broader population of fair value through P&L instruments, which could be SPPI or not SPPI, it could be based on business model or terms and conditions, then this agenda decision would not prevent you from doing that. It would just need to be in a different line item.
Yeah. So just to make clear, yes, so this is just saying, I use the word pure, it's maybe the wrong word. So all we're saying in this agenda decision or this decision you agree is that there is a line that kind of purely is interest revenue for interest for instruments or assets measured at amortized cost and for OCI subject to the hedging overlay. That's not preventing to the extent, you know, it meets the IAS 1 about being useful, you know, interest being calculated, separated out for other instruments and calculated in that way.
Okay, so then I am where the staff is. I just, reading the words, I'm finding...
That's all the agenda decision's going to... The draft agenda decision would simply be saying, in this line item, does it truly have to be only things that are actually measured at amortized cost and fair value OCI, silent on everything? So you could therefore still reach your conclusion in terms of choosing to separate out. And we're not officially opining on that. The challenge with that, of course, is... the reason why we were keen on it from a design perspective is because, and it was reinforced to me actually in the recent meeting we had with the Capital Markets Advisory Group, our user advisory group, they made a very big deal about the usefulness of the ability to see this particular interest revenue line item and know which amounts on the balance sheet it relates to.
Yeah,
and that
exactly
was part of the key part of the design from the staff perspective and the board at the time. John?
I mean, presumably somebody could disclose it as interest revenue calculated and not on a non-IFRS 9 EIR method.
In theory, I guess. We're not, and the agenda decision doesn't touch on that. The challenge is that some SPPI instruments aren't really bifurcatable in the traditional sense, and we have no guidance on it now. So,
I certainly agree with the usefulness of showing separately the amount of the interest earned on instruments measured at amortized cost. So I don't disagree with that. I'm just a little bit concerned about what the agenda decision would say then. So we would say that line item in IS-1 is specific to interest component on instruments measured at amortized cost, or the interest element on derivatives that are acting in a hedging relationship, and therefore would not explicitly preclude or permit you from showing other line items where you could show the interest components on instruments measured at fair value through P&L, like the convertible bond example that Bob gave, or presumably then somebody could show a revenue item if they wanted on derivatives on a non-hedging relationship?
Yes, and that's what the effect of the agenda decision would be. And this is part of where I said in the tee-up, we've been tried to be careful to try and contain this issue as much as we possibly can, because even today under IAS 39, I think there's an open question about whether or not you can slice and dice fair value through P&L items, and I think there may be a practice to do it, but, you know, IFRS 9 and the amendment to IAS 1 hasn't really changed that. So we're just trying to focus in on, you know, why did the board add these extra words, and to focus in on that in the agenda decision.
And only to say, near the end of the agenda decision, you'll see we put a starting point for trying to sort of make the scope of the agenda decision clear, the paragraph that starts, the committee did not consider, but, you know, perhaps this discussion will lead to saying we need to be a bit, you know, crisper or a bit clearer in that, assuming the committee agreed in that direction.
Okay, so on the basis of that discussion, can I see a show of hands from the committee on whether you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add this matter to your standard setting agenda?
Everybody?
Thank you. And then I think the particular points that I've heard in the discussion on the tentative agenda decision are making it clear that we're not saying that you can't put items associated with hedge accounting relationships into the line item, so we'll need to come up with some words to address that. And I think the other thing we need to be crystal clear with is what this agenda decision doesn't say, in a sense. We somehow need to make it clear that we're only commenting upon what's in this particular line item, and very carefully trying not to tread into the other questions about other item, line items that people may present. In the statement of concurrence. With those two amendments, can I get a show of hands on support for the tentative agenda decision?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Okay, thank you very much.